So welcome. We're in the synthesis of yoga and the yoga of integral knowledge. We're taking up a chapter now that saw its first publication on 15 December 1917. This is an essay that Sri Aurobindo never revised. It stands as he wrote and published it then. The chapter is The Higher and the Lower Knowledge. In the Arya, it followed the opening essay on the life divine, which was titled The Ascent Out of the Ignorance. The themes are connected. The higher and the lower knowledge. It's an idea that we see arise in the Upanishads, especially we have it marked in the Mundaka Upanishad. It is not one of the earliest. It is a metrical Upanishad that's still a couple of thousand years old, so ancient by any Western sense of measurement, but not as early as the great Upanishads like the Brihadaranyaka or the Chandogya or the Taittiriya or even the Kashitaki. But I thought we could begin with a few verses as translated by Sri Aurobindo. He was able to capture the grandeur, the sonority of the Sanskrit in his rendering into English. So I thought we would take a few verses from the Mundaka as our opening to this chapter. And he says, for instance, Shanaka, the great house lord, came to Angiras in the due way of the disciple and asked of him, Lord, by knowing what does all this that is become known? To him thus spoke Angiras, twofold is the knowledge that must be known, of which the knowers of the Brahman tell, the higher and the lower knowledge. This is that, the truth of things. Works which the sages beheld in the mantras were in the Treta manifoldly extended. Works do you perform religiously with one passion for the truth. This is your road to the heaven of good deeds. Those who dwell shut within the ignorance, and they hold themselves for learned men, thinking, we, even we, are the wise and the sages. Fools are they, and they wander around, beaten and stumbling, like blind men led by the blind. They dwell in many bonds of the ignorance, children thinking, we have achieved our aim of paradise. For when the men of works are held by their affections and arrive not at the knowledge, then they are overtaken by anguish. Then their paradise wastes by enjoying, and they fall from their heavens. Minds bewildered who hold the oblation offered and the well dug for the greatest righteousness and know not any other highest good. On the back of heaven, they enjoy the world won by their righteousness and enter again this or even a lower world. But they, who in the forest follow after faith and self-discipline, calm and full of knowledge, living upon alms, cast from them the dust of their passions, and through the gate of the sun they pass on there where is the immortal, the spirit, the self, undecaying and imperishable. The seeker of the Brahman, having put to the test the worlds piled up by works, arrives at world distaste. For not by work done is reached he who is uncreated. For the knowledge of that, let him approach, fuel in hand, a guru, one who has learned in the Veda and is devoted to contemplation of the Brahman. To him, because he has taken entire refuge with him, with a heart tranquilized and a spirit at peace, that man of knowledge declares in its principles the science of the Brahman, by which one comes to know the immutable spirit, the true and real. Then it moves on. This is that, the truth of things. As from one high kindled fire, thousands of different sparks are born, and all have the same form of fire. So, O fair sun, from the immutable manifold becomings are born, and even into that they depart. He, the divine, the formless spirit, even he is the outward and the inward, and he, the unborn. He is beyond life, beyond mind, luminous, supreme, beyond the immutable. Life and mind and the senses are born from him, and the sky, and the wind, and light, and the waters, and earth upholding all that is. I'll skip a number of verses and conclude with these two. From him are the oceans and all these mountains, and from him flow rivers of all forms, and from him are all plants and sensible delight, which makes the soul to abide with the material elements. The spirit is all this universe. He is works and tapas and the Brahman, supreme and immortal. O fair sun, he who knows this hidden in the secret heart scatters even here in this world the knot of the ignorance. Sometime we should just read an Upanishad from beginning to end, don't you think? But tonight we'll read half of this chapter, the higher and the lower knowledge, and we'll begin now. We have now completed our view of the path of knowledge and seen to what it leads. First, the end of yoga of knowledge is God possession. It is to possess God and be possessed by him through consciousness, through identification, through reflection of the divine reality. But not merely in some abstraction away from our present existence, but here also. Therefore, to possess the divine in himself, the divine in the world, the divine within, the divine in all things and all beings. It is to possess oneness with God, and through that to possess also oneness with the universal, with the cosmos and all existences. Therefore, to possess the infinite diversity also in the oneness, but on the basis of oneness and not on the basis of division. It is to possess God in his personality and his impersonality, in his purity, free from qualities, and in his infinite qualities, in time and beyond time, in his action and in his silence, in the finite and in the infinite. It is to possess him not only in pure self, but in all self, not only in self, but in nature, not only in spirit, but in supermind, mind, life, and body. To possess him with the spirit, with the mind, with the vital and the physical consciousness, and it is again for all these to be possessed by him, so that our whole being is one with him, full of him, governed and driven by him. It is, since God is oneness, for our physical consciousness to be one with the soul and with the nature of the material universe, for our life to be one with all life, for our mind to be one with the universal mind, for our spirit to be identified with the universal spirit. It is to merge in him in the absolute and find him in all relations. So that's God possession. Secondly, it is to put on the divine being and the divine nature. And since God is Satchit-Ananda, it is to raise our being into the divine being, our consciousness into the divine consciousness, our energy into the divine energy, our delight of existence into the divine delight of being. And always good historically to note that Satchit-Ananda is a term that does not arise in the early Upanishads, but comes late. It arises first in the Muktika Upanishad around the 4th or 5th century of the Common Era, also in Vasudeva, also in Rama Uttara Tapani. These three reveal that the term is affixed first in theistic Vedanta. Later, hundreds of years later, it's taken up by Advaita Vedanta. Shankara doesn't touch the term because originally it is associated with the divine as a person. Shankara won't have anything to do with it. But for the term Satchit-Ananda, let's remember it always refers to a conscious being whose nature is bliss. We'll continue. And it is not only to lift ourselves into this higher consciousness, but to widen it, but to widen into it in all our being, because it is to be found on all the planes of our existence and in all our members, so that our mental, vital, physical existence shall become full of the divine nature. You'll remember in The Life Divine, he describes an omnipresent reality. One divinity expressed in the utterest heights of spirit and in the lowest deposition of nature, There is nothing that is absent the divine presence. All speaks to it. All can reveal it. Our intelligent mentality is to become a play of the divine knowledge will. Our mental soul life, a play of the divine love and delight. Our vitality, a play of the divine life. Our physical being, a mold of the divine substance. So this fullness of Satchit Ananda, this Purnam, is to be exhibited in all the range of our existence, that Satchit Ananda should finally become manifest in every plane of being. It should stand forth, not be a secret hidden existence, but the full term of evolution should disclose all these powers through all the forms radiantly. This God action in us is to be realized by an opening of ourselves to the divine gnosis and the divine ananda, and in its fullness by an ascent into and a permanent dwelling in the gnosis and the ananda. Because following the Taittiriya Upanishad, the whole stream of the involved cosmos begins with the seas of ananda pouring themselves through the vijnana, the wide truth consciousness, the vast awareness of the supramental in which knowledge and will are one, down through the stadia of mind, life, and matter. So as we climb back up this scale, we should recover gnosis, the supramental. We should recover bliss, delight, the nature of ananda. For although we live physically on the material plane and in normal outward-going life, the mind and soul are preoccupied with material existence, this externality of our being is not a binding limitation. We can raise our internal consciousness from plane to plane of the relations of Purusha with Prakriti and even become, instead of the mental being, dominated by the physical soul and nature, the Gnostic being, or the bliss self, and assume the Gnostic or the bliss nature. So he implies that we can grow upwards while remaining seated in the body, including and integrating all into the enlarged consciousness and the powers of that consciousness. So, and by this raising of the inner life, we can transform our whole outward going existence. Instead of a life dominated by matter, we shall then have a life dominated by spirit, with all its circumstances molded and determined by the purity of being, the consciousness infinite, even in the finite, the divine energy, the divine joy and bliss of the spirit. This is a supreme reversal. This is the goal. We have seen also what are the essentials of the method. But here we have first to consider briefly one side of the question of method, which we have hitherto left untouched. In the system of an integral yoga, the principle must be that all life is a part of the yoga. But the knowledge which we have been describing seems to be not the knowledge of what is ordinarily understood as life, but of something beyond life. There are two kinds of knowledge. That which seeks to understand the apparent phenomenon of existence externally by an approach from outside through the intellect, this is the lower knowledge, the knowledge of the apparent world. Secondly, the knowledge which seeks to know the truth of existence from within, in its source and reality, by spiritual realization. So one, the lower is the apara vidya, and the higher is the para vidya. Note again that he says, the apparent phenomenon of existence externally. So we see multifaceted display from Prakriti. To the witnessing spirit, there is only one phenomenon. There is only one Prakriti. There are not many. So a distinction worth noting. Ordinarily, a sharp distinction is drawn between the two, the higher and the lower knowledge. And it is supposed that when we get to the higher knowledge, the God knowledge, then the rest, the world knowledge, becomes of no concern to us. But in reality, they are two sides of one seeking. All knowledge is ultimately the knowledge of God through himself, through nature, through her works. Mankind has first to seek this knowledge through the external life. For until its mentality is sufficiently developed, spiritual knowledge is not really possible. And in proportion as it is developed, the possibilities of spiritual knowledge become richer and fuller. So all those sciences, methods of knowledge, which we would count as not quite reaching the deep truth available to Brahma Vidya, the knowledge of Brahman, still are worth our exploration, our acquisition, our time, our development. In fact, can we really evolve to the point that we can know the higher realms of the spirit unless we have done this? So yes, we must grapple with nature and learn her arts. Science, art, philosophy, ethics, psychology, the knowledge of man and his past, action itself, are means by which we arrive at the knowledge of the workings of God through nature and through life. At first, it is the workings of life and forms of nature which occupy us. But as we go deeper and deeper and get a completer view and experience, each of these lines brings us face to face with God. Science, at its limits, even physical science, is compelled to perceive in the end the infinite, the universal, the spirit, the divine intelligence and will in the material universe. Quite visible in Isaac Newton and Albert Einstein, though separated by centuries and a world apart in their views of what nature is. Still more easily must this be the end with the psychic sciences, which deal with the operations of higher and subtler planes and powers of our being, and come into contact with the beings and the phenomena of the worlds behind, which are unseen, not sensible by our physical organs, but ascertainable by the subtle mind and senses. He is talking here about the whole field of occultism, which he deems a field of knowledge. Art leads to the same end. The aesthetic human being, intensely preoccupied with nature through aesthetic emotion, must in the end arrive at spiritual emotion and perceive not only the infinite life, but the infinite presence within her. Preoccupied with beauty in the life of man, he must in the end come to see the divine, the universal, the spiritual in humanity. Of course, when Mother rejoins him in 1920 and gradually takes over the leadership of the ashram, one thing that she does powerfully in manifold ways is to introduce the idea of the art of yoga as the yoga of art, that we can grow into the sublime, into the supreme, through the various fields of beauty. Whether they're in the plastic arts, or the musical arts, or the visual arts, or architecture itself. And of course, ranging outside the ashram, we can find this idea of beauty leading one to immersion in the divine, in the impressive artwork, the revealing artwork of Nicholas Rarik, the Russian painter who so loved India that his last days were spent in the Himalayas. Philosophy, dealing with the principles of things, must come to perceive the principle of all these principles and investigate its nature, attributes, and essential workings. I do wish philosophy good luck finding its way back to just that very thing. So, ethics must eventually perceive that the law of good which it seeks is the law of God and depends on the being and nature of the master of the law. Psychology leads from the study of mind and the soul in living beings to the perception of the one soul and one mind in all things and beings. The history and study of man, like the history and study of nature, lead towards the perception of the eternal and universal power and being whose thought and will work out through the cosmic and human evolution. So we are being driven forward both in spheres of psychology and sociology by biology itself and discovering how intimately connected is the web of life. And what is it that vivifies life is yet to be discovered, individually and generally. But we are slowly getting there. See not just the headlines in the newspaper. Attend not just the five-minute news summary at the start of every hour. Look behind the appearances to that which continues to throb and grow. It is the soul. Cosmic and individual in you. Action itself forces us into contact with the divine power which works through, uses, overrules our actions. The intellect begins to perceive and understand, the emotions to feel and desire and revere, the will to turn itself to the service of the divine, without whom nature and man cannot exist or move, and by conscious knowledge of whom alone we can arrive at our highest possibilities. You can feel in these words how the Supreme is whispering in Sri Aurobindo's ears these words of encouragement, driving him forward here at the close of 1917. Keep going. Don't attend to the darkness of World War I. There is a glorious future waiting, and you are central to its exploration, its exposition, its eventual celebration. It is here that yoga steps in. It begins by using knowledge, emotion, and action for the possession of the divine. So here we're speaking about Siddhi, fulfillment, Aishwarya, the mastery of the nature. For yoga is the conscious and perfect seeking of a union with the divine towards which all the rest was an ignorant and imperfect moving and seeking. At first, then, yoga separates itself from the action and method of the lower knowledge. For while this lower knowledge approaches God indirectly from outside and never enters his secret dwelling place, yoga calls us within and approaches him directly. While that seeks him through the intellect and becomes conscious of him from behind a veil, yoga seeks him through realization, lifts the veil, and gets the full vision. Where that only feels the presence and the influence, yoga enters into the presence and fills itself with the influence. Where that is only aware of the workings and through them gets some glimpse of the reality, yoga identifies our inner being with the reality and sees from that the workings. Therefore, the methods of yoga are different from the methods of the lower knowledge. We'll put a bookmark there and finish the chapter next time. But this is the intent of the seeker: to thrust aside all that veils, all that distorts, all that separates, and arrive at the direct, intimate experience, the making real of the divine presence, consciousness, and delight in oneself, the deepest self, and then concordantly through all the elements of the natural self. This means one has to be fearless, abhaya, because it is easy for us to put a votary image, to put a phrase, to put an icon, to put an institution in front of us and do good work with that and those and not get to the experience. Stuff and nonsense. We are here to penetrate, to strike that down if necessary, but to have the experience of the absolute here in the relativities of time. So here's a selection from Savitri for tonight. This is in Book One, the Book of Beginnings, Canto 3, The Yoga of the Soul's Release. Pardon me. And we're going to begin on page 42. A darkness carrying morning in its breast looked for the eternal wide returning gleam, waiting the advent of a larger ray and rescue of the lost herds of the sun. In a splendid extravagance of the waste of God, dropped carelessly in creation's spendthrift work, left in the chantiers of the bottomless world, and stolen by the robbers of the deep, the golden shekels of the eternal lie, hoarded from touch and view and thought's desire, locked in blind antres of the ignorant flood, lest men should find them and be even as gods. A vision lightened on the viewless heights, a wisdom illumined from the voiceless depths, a deeper interpretation, greatened truth, a grand reversal of the night and day, all the world's values changed, heightening life's aim. A wiser word, a larger thought came in than what the slow labor of human mind can bring. A secret sense awoke that could perceive a presence and a greatness everywhere. The universe was not now, this senseless whirl, born round inert on an immense machine. It cast away its grandiose, lifeless front, a mechanism no more or work of chance, but a living movement of the body of God. A spirit hid in forces and in forms was the spectator of the mobile scene. The beauty and the ceaseless miracle let in a glow of the unmanifest. The formless everlasting moved in it, seeking its own perfect form in souls and things. Life kept no more a dull and meaningless shape. In the struggle and upheaval of the world, he saw the labor of a Godhead's birth. A secret knowledge masked as ignorance. Fate covered with an unseen necessity, the game of chance of an omnipotent will. A glory and a rapture and a charm, the all-blissful sat unknown within the heart. Earth's pains were the ransom of its prisoned delight. A glad communion tinged the passing hours. The days were travelers on a destined road, the nights companions of his musing spirit. A heavenly impetus quickened all his breast. The trudge of time changed to a splendid march. The divine dwarf towered to unconquered worlds. Earth grew too narrow for his victory. Once only registering the heavy tread of a blind power on human littleness, life now became a sure approach to God, existence a divine experiment, and cosmos the soul's opportunity. The world was a conception and a birth of spirit and matter into living forms, and nature bore the immortal in her womb that she might climb through him to eternal life. His being lay down in bright, immobile peace and bathed in wells of pure spiritual light. It wandered in wide fields of wisdom self, lit by the rays of an everlasting sun. Even his body's subtle self within could raise the earthly parts towards higher things and feel on it the breath of heavenlier air. Already it journeyed towards divinity, upbuoyed upon winged winds of rapid joy, upheld to a light it could not always hold. It left mind's distance from the truth supreme and lost life's incapacity for bliss. All now suppressed in us began to emerge. Well, there we leave it. Namaste, Jai Ma.